In this episode of What's the Story, Old Glory, we continue our look at Trump's legal woes. And today, it's his alleged retention of classified documents at the Mar-a-Lago Resort in Florida. And in past glory, we talk about the only president to have served two non-consecutive terms, Grover Cleveland.
Hi, and welcome to What's the Story, Old Glory. My name is Todd Muller, coming to you, as nearly often is the case, from a very beautiful Tauranga this morning. And of course, my colleague, Elizabeth, where are you tuning in from?
From my normal home base in Oamaru in North Otago. And again, beautiful here today. A stark contrast to yesterday when it felt like winter had well and truly hit. We had a good dousing of rain yesterday, but it was much needed because we're close to drought conditions down here at the moment. It's been a long, hot, dry summer and we haven't had any decent rain in weeks. So that was a blessing.
A bit of an irony that you go over to America and it rains. In the dry states of Nevada, and then come back to Oamaru, and it's beautiful and dry, but it has been a great summer, hasn't it? And I guess our regular listeners will say, well, where have you guys been for the last couple of 3 weeks? But we do have these other pesky things called jobs and obligations and stuff, don't we?
Yeah, we've had difficulty scheduling our podcasting around our away from podcasting lives, but we're back. And we are now in the business end of the season in terms of the election. We've passed Super Tuesday. We're now down to a two-horse race, and we're looking forward to the conventions that are yet to come.
And aren't those horses in fine condition? Perhaps a good mule race would be better, but
I'm not going to use the word thoroughbreds.
No, not thoroughbred at all. Goodness me. So Super Tuesday, let's have a quick chat about that. Obviously on the Democratic side, big wins all round for Biden. And as we've discussed before, just a couple of minor players just sort of in the race for either profile or just wanting to make a personal statement. But there was, and he did what you'd expect, this is Biden, taking everything but one. Just tell us a little bit about this result in American Samoa.
Yeah, so American Samoa is one of the territories that isn't a state, but obviously its citizens do get to vote. And Biden lost the primary to a rank outsider who we haven't even talked about, from Maryland. I believe he's a congressman, but he essentially ran a completely online campaign in Western Samoa, American Samoa, and focused on education as his platform, and took it by a landslide.
Yes, what a surprise. Amazing. Yeah, quite amazing. Obviously, just a sort of a note in history, really, because Biden has subsequently clinched the nomination as expected for the Democratic Party. And the Republicans, well, I guess as expected, Trump got there, but not without a couple of bruises, Elizabeth. So where did Haley finally manage to land a punch?
Yeah, so Nikki Haley took out the delegates for Vermont and Washington DC, but it was a surprise, but not a surprise. There were always going to be delegates going her way. The question was how many, but it was never going to be enough to upset Trump. And she had said that she was going to stay in the race until Super Tuesday, which was when that big chunk of states did their primary voting, which is what she did. She's now bowed out, but she has stopped short of endorsing Trump. Whether she will or not, I'm not sure, but I suspect this won't be the last that we'll see of her. She'll be back in future years, I'm thinking.
Yeah, and so obviously a big win for former President Trump, and a couple of smaller primaries subsequent to Super Tuesday has now officially given him the delegates needed to be the nominee. And so, as you said, it's rematch time. President Biden versus President Trump,
And we're already seeing the sort of them getting into that debate mode, because we had President Biden last week presented his State of the Union address to Congress, where he was given a standing ovation by Democrats, not surprisingly. And Trump and his supporters came out on the attack and did essentially they were rubbishing everything that he said. There was one young Republican congresswoman who's already been fact-checked for some of the things she was saying about a woman that was kidnapped and taken into Mexico, but she was saying it was a result of Biden's border policies and it was alternative facts, if I could put it that way. And Trump came out on his attack doing his alternative State of the Union address, and he got pretty personal with Biden, mocking him for having a stutter and that sort of thing. So yeah, this is what we've got to look forward to from now until November.
Yeah, just 6 months of punching hard from both sides. I do find the State of the Union, I don't know if many of our listeners ever get to see snippets of it, but it goes for about an hour and a half. And part of the reason the speech goes for so long is every time the president says something remotely positive, all of the Democrats, senators and congressmen, stand up and give a 30-second standing ovation. Like tens and tens of these, you know, times that they do it through the speech. I don't know about you, but I find it all a bit pedestrian after a while. I mean, as a speaker, you like to get a few cheers, but to have everyone stand up every time you say something, you know, every second sentence, and then, of course, hilariously, no one on the Republican side is clapping or doing anything remotely looking like they're interested. I mean, it is just theatre, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. So, like, they did a few close-ups of Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's a Republican, in the, as they call it, the MAGA camp, the Make America Great Again camp, and she was wearing a Trump hat and heckling Joe Biden and that sort of thing. And that one of the things I find interesting is that Joe Biden brought up the border bill, protection immigration bill, that was attempted to be a bipartisan solution to the border crisis that America is fighting at the moment. And Trump has told Republicans in the House that they should not vote in favor of the bill. And I was thinking about how odd that is from a New Zealand perspective, that you can have someone that's not even elected, not even within, technically within government, having such an outsize influence on policy. It's a really interesting situation.
Never happened in New Zealand, partly, I think, because of our Westminster system, and it is really only over there because, you know, the Republicans, for really, I still haven't quite got my head around why, are entirely beholden to him. And I, you know, I can't understand, particularly after the January 6th riots or insurrection, depending on your point of view, in the Capitol building in 2021, when initially so many Republicans, I think quite rightly, condemned Trump's obvious and clear encouragement for that sort of behaviour to happen. Within 72 hours, had backed down and, you know, had decided that actually it wasn't that bad after all. And of course, as we know, the Democrats, again, no doubt quite partisanly, trying to impeach Trump for that behaviour. I think only six or seven Republicans voted for that. All the rest swung in behind Trump. And, you know, it's just, it is extraordinary when you reflect, and I'm not naming names for obvious reasons, but, you know, in the New Zealand political context, when people have their challenges that, you know, potentially even involve being in front of a court, you know, it's just a very, very different world, isn't it? When, you know, Trump has got, you know, 91 charges. As if I got that right, 91 charges.
It's in the 90s, certainly. We're going to go through 40 odd of them today.
Yeah, we'll go through a few 40 odd of them today. And, you know, the Republicans swinging behind him, he's got every chance of being re-elected president. It's just such a world. So tell us, we had a really good, you had an impressive, a tour de force run through of some of his legal challenges last time, and you're going to guide us through a few more this morning. So why don't you start us on that?
Thank you. So, just want to say before I start, I had some really nice listener feedback actually about our last episode where we went through the cases in front of Trump in relation to election interference, both federal and in Georgia. And so I just want to say thank you to our listeners for providing us that feedback. That was really nice. Thank you. So there are two more sort of sets of charges that Trump is facing. The plan was to go through two of them today, the classified documents case and the hush money case. But the classified documents indictment is long. There are 40 charges in there. So probably not going to have time to traverse both. So we'll do the classified documents case today. And then in our next episode, we'll get on to what's perhaps the most salacious, which is the hush money case in New York about money being paid to Stormy Daniels and others. In the lead up to the 2016 election. So the classified documents case is being brought against Trump in Florida because that's the scene of the alleged crimes. It is a federal case though, so it's not Florida law that he's alleged to have breached. It's the US code, so the federal law. What I'll do is I'll go through the counts, of which there are many, and then we'll talk a bit about the sort of background to how this all came about. So it's Trump and a co-conspirator, Waltine Nauta, who was one of his aides, and they're alleged to have done some of this together. So counts 1 to 31 relate to willful retention of national defense information. And so this is this this these counts are essentially a table, a list of 31 documents that had classified status, top secret, classified relating to things like White House intelligence briefings relating to foreign countries, documents relating to the US military capabilities, military contingency planning, regional military capabilities, foreign policy, timelines and details of potentially attacking a foreign country. So really top secret stuff that he is alleged to have willfully retained after he left the office of president. Then we go on to count 32, which is sounds similar to some of the other ones we've heard about, conspiracy to obstruct justice. And so this is him and his conspirator, Mr. Nauta, conspired to engage in misleading conduct and corruptly persuade another person to withhold documents and other objects from official proceedings. So essentially what this relates to is that when the FBI started an investigation into whether Trump was holding classified documents at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, basically he and Walt signed some official documentation saying that they didn't have the documents and they'd conducted a thorough search and returned. They did return some documents, but not all of them. And so essentially, because they had signed that, they were obstructing justice because what they had provided to the FBI was false. Count 33, withholding a document or record. Count 34, corruptly concealing a document or record. Count 35, concealing a document in a federal investigation. Count 36, scheme to conceal. Count 37, false statements and representations. We keep going. Count 38, false statements and representations. And then two more have since been added to that along the same lines. Now, these are very serious charges. So on the there's a penalty sheet that has been produced, which sets out what all the maximum fines and terms of imprisonment are if Trump and his co-conspirator are found, alleged co-conspirator are found to be guilty of these offenses. And so the minimum that he's looking at for just one count is 5 years, but some of them, like corruptly concealing a document or record, has a max term of imprisonment of 20 years and a maximum fine of $250,000. So when you times that by 38, that's a long stretch in prison potentially if he's found guilty in any or all of these. New Zealand courts have a tendency, if they do sentence on multiple counts like this, to calculate sentences concurrently, but US courts are a bit different and tend to do it concurrently. So you'd be serving them back to back to back to back. So we're looking at, you know, 100 years in prison potentially if he's found guilty on these charges.
Well, that's talk about tour de force. That was brilliant. Listening to that, I'm thinking, this is, I mean, last time when you stepped through, you know, that those particular cases, they seem pretty open and shut. This one feels even more robust from a prosecutorial perspective. We've all seen those boxes, the picture of the boxes in his glitzy bathroom.
Out with the chandelier.
And it just, I guess one question, how could you, is there any defense that he didn't quite realize what was there? And the reason I'm going to frame this up is every president has their library. They create a library after they retire and they put all their documents and you know, papers and perspectives, and people can, it becomes a library of their history. Now, clearly, very top secret documents aren't there, or at least are not initially. Maybe over time they're released to that library. Is there a defense which says, look, I didn't realize exactly what was in the middle of all of this. I wasn't intending to keep that sort of highly sensitive documentation. This was all documentation for my Donald Trump library, which I'm planning, and you know, that's my defense. Seems pretty flimsy the way I've articulated it. Thoughts?
So the case has been procedurally before the Florida court this week, actually, because Trump's lawyers have argued two sort of areas of defense. The first one being that the Espionage Act, which is one of the acts that he's being charged under the US Criminal Code, is constitutionally vague. Now, therefore doesn't pass the sort of constitutionality test of being able to prosecute someone. The judge has said issued a ruling on that. So what Trump's lawyers were trying to do by arguing that was by getting the whole case thrown out, essentially, before it even began. But the judge issued a ruling on that motion straight away and said it's premature for that to be determined now, essentially saying that's a matter for the Supreme Court because that's where constitutionality in terms of statutes and that sort of thing gets determined. The other branch of their defense is what you've talked about. So there's a piece of legislation which is called the Presidential Records Act, Administration Records Act, I think it is. And essentially what that does is it's saying that the president has the right to all their documents to be kept personal and they are secret, and the president can do with what they want whilst they are in office. But once they are out of office, the argument is, well, that ends. There is provision for certain documents to be retained and be retain their confidentiality and not become a public record for a period of 5 years, and that sometimes can be extended to 12, and this doesn't include classified documentation and that sort of stuff. But that legislation, I think, was brought in the early 80s, and it's essentially to ensure that the public has a record of what happened during the presidency, like Nixon's tapes, for instance, which are what brought him down in Watergate, that they became a matter of public record. That's definitely going to be one of the defenses that Trump is going to run when this case goes to hearing. So it's still in process. The other thing about this case that also makes it seem more open and shut than some of the others is, as well as the photos of the documents in the bathroom, I'm looking at one at the moment that's actually piles of file boxes in the ballroom at Mar-a-Lago on the stage. There are recordings of him talking about what's in some of these documents to other people. So you can hear him showing to an interviewer a classified document about US military secrets. And because there's a recording of that, that's pretty hard to deny. And that was after the presidency finished. Interestingly as well, there's another There are text messages between him and Mr. Nolte and other Trump attorneys and staff talking about moving around the documents, talking about we're being asked by the FBI to produce these, and Trump saying things like, can't we just deny it? Can't we just ignore them? Can't we just make the documents go away? And there's also a picture that relates to New Zealand, believe it or not. It shows one of the file boxes in a storage cupboard in Mar-a-Lago, and it's fallen off the top of a pile. And you can see in the spread of documents that's on the floor, there's a title on one of them that says secret/rel to USA's FVEY. And what that means is that this is information in a document releasable only to the governments of the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance, consisting of Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the United States. And you can see it on the floor of the storage room, along with copies of the Washington Post and other newspapers. It's just amazing.
That's that picture, if you can grab that, we need to put that on our podcast.
Sure, we'll put it on our social media pages.
Yeah, because that would be, that's great. I'd love to see that. So two questions. What's the timing of this? Everyone, mm-hmm. I'm sure, is interested in, is this going to come to a conclusion this side of November? And secondly, if it doesn't, what, and Trump then wins the presidency, what power does Trump have to stop these proceedings, if any, and or get himself off by pardoning himself if he is indeed found guilty?
Mm. The hearing was originally set down for May, but that's looking unlikely because these other motions have been filed in between. Like all of the cases, there are motions being filed all over the show. I don't know if any of our listeners have read the book Bleak House by Charles Dickens, but I was thinking about that this morning when I was going through some of this, because it's a very, very thick book, and it's essentially about a brother and sister and the lives of the people around them who are caught in this endless cycle of litigation around this family's estate, because the lawyers just keep filing motion after motion after motion after motion, and it goes on for years and years and years. And that's kind of what this feels like. There's just so many motions being thrown about. The prosecution want all these cases heard before the election. They want to get it done as quickly as possible. It's in Trump's interests to have it delayed until after the election, because if he's elected president, it's likely that a hold will have to go on all these proceedings, because he's a sitting president and can't be distracted from his duties as, you know, the chief of the free world. If he's having to attend court hearings and that sort of thing. So this one in particular, they had filed a timeline that it be heard in July, but the judge has said that they don't think that that's realistic. So it may be later in the year. In relation to one of the other cases, the Georgia election interference case, you may remember that the Trump's team had filed a motion to have Fani Willis, who's the prosecutor in that case, her entire office thrown off the case, saying that there was a conflict of interest between her and one of her special prosecutors. We got the ruling from the judge yesterday. The judge said, no, although there was potentially a conflict, her office can still maintain its prosecution. It doesn't have to start again, as long as the special prosecutor with whom the district attorney had the affair with is no longer off on the case. She can stay on the case, but not the special counsel that she had employed. So that's still going to be going ahead. If Trump is prosecuted, found guilty on any of these things, and either goes to jail or gets fined, as I understand it, and it may be that we need to have one of our American law experts back on to talk about this in a bit more depth, it's likely he would be able to pardon himself as president. He has those powers. And even if he didn't, he would probably get released from prison. I think this is what Professor Lindquist talked to us about a few months back, because he wouldn't be able to undertake his duties in office if he were in prison. So he would get released, even if he wasn't able to pardon himself, serve his term, and presumably go back to jail upon the end of his term.
You wouldn't read about this, would you?
You wouldn't. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up. No one would believe you.
No one would believe you. And extraordinary. Wow, that, as I said, I have to, this case feels to me the most open and shut, bluntly. But, you know, as you say, you've outlined very well the two defences that he will attempt to pursue beyond the obvious continuing delaying tactics, which is a strategy across all of these. And we will see what comes next.
Yes, in relation to the defamation case with E. Jean Carroll that he was found guilty in, guilty of defaming her, he has posted his $90-odd million bond. So he is able to lodge a defence, an appeal in that case, because he's lodged his bond.
Yeah. And the other one, the business dealings one, that was a huge bond required if he was appealing that, wasn't it?
That was hundreds of millions. Yes. So I don't think the clock has run out on that one yet.
No, yes, he'll be still asking his supporters around the country to chuck a few $5 in the pot to help him do it, no doubt, as we discussed last time. Quite amazing.
Yep.
Extraordinary.
Right, so that's where we're up at with Trump's cases. As I say, next time we're on to the juiciest of them all, perhaps, which is the hush money case involving Stormy Daniels, a doorman, and a Playboy model. So that's going to be interesting. But now let's turn to our usual slot of past glory, where we profile a former president. And because I've spent a lot of time talking already, we're going to hand that over to you for who's your pick this episode.
Well, I have decided on Grover Cleveland, and he is the 22nd president of the United States and also the 24th president of the United States. So our listeners would quickly have identified that he sounds like somebody who was elected president, lost, and then got reelected. And that's exactly what happened. To date, the only president in American history who has served two non-consecutive terms. So I thought in the context of Donald J. Trump finally securing the nomination to be the Republican candidate, he is going to stand for his third consecutive election, just like Grover Cleveland did back in the 1880s. So Grover Cleveland was born in 1837, died in 1908. His rise to political fame was in New York. He was the elected mayor of New York in 1881. He was elected mayor in Buffalo, New York in 1881, and then elected governor of New York in 1882. And as we know, even today, the New York is a powerhouse of political leaders, and it certainly was the case back in the 1800s. He became the Democratic nominee for the 1884 election, and the Republican president at the time was Chester A. Arthur, who became president on the assassination of James Garfield and was not particularly well respected, came from the wrong grouping within the Republican Party. And so the Republicans nominated a Mr. Blaine, James G. Blaine of Maine, and he was their candidate, and Grover Cleveland was the Democratic candidate. It was a very, very close election. Grover Cleveland won by 30,000 votes, 4.87 million versus 4.84 million. But as you know, I liked talking about the events of the campaign. He portrayed himself as a very much an honest man compared with the corrupt Republicans who had been in power essentially nonstop since the Civil War. And the New York Times offered four reasons for endorsing Cleveland. One, he is an honest man. Two, he is an honest man. Three, he is an honest man. Four, he is an honest man. Now, the problem with being so forward leaning with respect to your integrity on issue in issues like this politically, is that if it turns out that you possibly have done something in your past that's not ideal, that tends to blow up in your face, as this did with a Buffalo newspaper after he had been nominated, publishing what it called, and I quote, "a terrible tale, a dark chapter in a public man's history." And the article claimed that as a young man, Cleveland had taken up with a 36-year-old widow, fathered a son, and continued to support them financially. Cleveland then confirmed the story when his campaign staff asked how they should handle the affair. He said, "above all, tell the truth," which is quite something.
Honest.
Very honest. And of course, that then started one of the most aggressive campaigns in history. The New York Sun described Cleveland as a coarse debauchee who would bring his harlots with him to Washington, which just gives you a sense, by the way, that American politics has never been for the faint-hearted. I mean, we look at some of the one-liners that are thrown from Trump to Biden and Biden back, and we think, gosh, that's a bit, you know, a bit rough. Well, it's always been rough in America. Among Cleveland's defenders was Mark Twain, who retaliated in kind, saying that he found Blaine's lying about his record so offensive that, and I quote, "I don't seem to be able to lie with any heart lately," unquote. So Blaine looked like he was going to win. Cleveland closed it up and frankly just won the electoral vote 219 to 182. That all swung on New York, which Cleveland won by 1,200 votes. To give you a sense of this campaign, victory was sweet. In taunting Cleveland during the campaign over a scandalous past, Republicans had chanted, this is in meetings, public meetings, "Ma, ma, where's my pa?" Which is joking, of course, about the fact that he had illegitimately fathered a son. Oh, and now after winning, the Democrats chanted in reply, "gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." So I tell you, they certainly knew how to fire shots back in those days. So in 1888, Grover Cleveland stands for a second term. He's up against Benjamin Harrison. It was, again, a very tough race. Harrison wins the Electoral College, but Cleveland wins the popular vote. And that was the last time that happened up until Al Gore in 2000. So you think about this in American history. 1888 was the last time that a person won the popular vote but did not win the presidency. That then happened in 2000 and again happened in 2016. With Hillary Clinton. And so people thought that that would be the end of the story for Grover Cleveland. That's not the case. He stood again in 1892 for the third time, just like Donald Trump, this time because of an impact of a third party candidate from the People's Party, often known as the Populists. Mr. Weaver got 1 million votes and 22 electoral votes, split the vote across those states, which meant that Cleveland won comfortably in the Electoral College and won the popular vote by over 4 million. Saw out his second term and finished, a reasonably respected politician. And like I said, managed to achieve what up until now in American history has only ever been done by Mr. Grover Cleveland, standing for election three times in a row and winning twice as president. And as we know, Donald Trump is seeking to do the same thing this year. And I would be interested, I know a number of our listeners are quite interested in just how the polls are going. I had a look at 538.com, mm-hmm. 270 to win. And in those five or six really tight races, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, it is very, very close. In fact, across all those four, Trump has a very, very small margin lead in the polls, like 1 or 2%. And as we've discussed before, you know, those 4 or 5 states where they go will decide the presidency. And it's already neck and neck, and it's been neck and neck for a month or two, and we've got 6 months to go. And
that's,
I suspect,
right. And it's going to come down to small numbers.
It's going to be
a tight, tight race.
Very tight race. And I was just going to say, and I suspect the abuse between the two candidates will very much live up to the Grover Cleveland and James Blaine type of campaigning of 1884.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting. It'll also be interesting to see if the third party candidate has an effect on the overall result, because RFK Jr., we've talked about him before, he's still there. He's still there as a candidate. He's been holding some really interesting fundraising events. He's been getting some interesting celebrities to endorse him, like Rob Schneider, the comedian actor, is a good friend of his. And so, for instance, you can spend several thousand dollars and get to go on RFK's yacht with him in California, spend an afternoon with him, that sort of stuff. So those are the sorts of things he's doing to raise money. And he is doing a big event in a couple of weeks to announce his running mate. So who would be his vice president were he to get elected? So I don't think it'll be Rob Schneider, but who knows?
Well,
who knows with him?
There's talk about, is it Jerry Ventura, the wrestler guy? That he's apparently one of the... Yeah, he's Jesse Ventura. He's seen as one of the potential vice presidential candidates. And he's on the ballot on a few of the states, which is, I think we should circle back and, you know, as this gets closer to be real clear around how many states he's actually on the ballot for, because, you know, in each state, they will have obviously Biden and Trump listed, but in some cases we'll have Kennedy, but in not all cases. And also they can write in, which is something that I've always been fascinated about. In New Zealand, if you write something on the ballot paper beyond what is there, that's then immediately invalid. But in America, you can write in and say, you know, I want Elizabeth Soule, and you will get a vote, which I've always found quite remarkable.
That is interesting.
Well, perhaps not you, because they'll realize that you're a, you know, you're an alien. You're not a New Zealand, not a American citizen.
Fortunately, I'm not eligible. That's the only thing stopping me, really.
Yes, well, you and me both, you know, my history on this. But so there we go. Very interesting time awaits us over the next. Just finally, before we go, because you've been great on, you've been superb actually on the legal side. Just thinking about debates, you know, we started this last August with our first discussion looking at the first primary with all those talking heads. And of course, now all distilled down to Donald Trump. The debates are pretty fascinating. They certainly were the last two elections. What's your sense about Biden v. Trump televised debates? And because you'd think that that would be a massive risk potentially for Biden, who seems really only capable of reading a teleprompter as opposed to standing on a stage for 2 hours with Trump. What's your thoughts? Have you read anything around what the plan is there?
Yeah, no, I haven't. But the interesting thing about Biden in terms of what a lot of his supporters say, and they talk about this in relation to some of the things he's done in terms of this State of the Union address and the previous State of the Union address as well. Even though he appears quite frail and dottery, he can respond on the debate stage effectively, particularly with some good zingers. So famously, I think it was the last State of the Union, he managed to get the Republicans in the room to agree not to cut spending on welfare benefits and veterans, which is something that hadn't happened. And it was just the way he managed to frame the back and forth, the heckling that was going on. And so he can do that quite well. Trump, as we know, has a really interesting presence, and it doesn't necessarily come across on TV to a remote audience like people in New Zealand, we sometimes look at him and think he seems kind of buffoonish and somewhat clownish and goes on these rambling rants, which he does do. But from what I understand, if you're in his presence, he does have quite a sort of a dynamic way about him that people, certain people in particular, feel drawn to. And he manages to shut people down, not in a nice way necessarily, but he seems to just be able to undercut them so that they lose any ability to be able to respond effectively to him, even if he's not telling the truth. And we saw this with Hillary Clinton, the way he sort of stalked her around the stage. It was quite creepy, but it was effective for his voters. And so it's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out. The debates have to happen. Neither of them can back away from them because it would just be political suicide. You're essentially conceding to your opponent that you've got nothing to offer in terms of rebutting them. But there is commentary coming out of the States that this election could be quite different in terms of you might not see as much on the ground, the candidates traveling around state to state, doing as many rallies and that sort of thing, because it might be a waste of money and energy, because a lot of those people who attend the rallies have already decided. You're preaching to the choir. It's going to be those key battleground states that we've talked about where people are undecided. You might have people that are anyone but Trump who can't decide whether to vote for Biden, or may not want, are worried that if Biden was to die in office, for instance, that Harris would take over. She's broadly disliked for whatever reason that might be. But then you'll have other Republicans who would never vote for a Democrat, who will always vote for Trump. So there's a lot of issues are going to be going through these voters' minds when they go to cast their votes. And so I think the debates are going to be quite key for some people to helping them make up their minds as to which way they're going to vote.
Very good. Gosh, it's going to be so exciting. Can't wait. Well, I hope you've enjoyed listening to our latest update from that crazy country, and looking forward to catching up again in a couple of weeks' time. And thanks again, Elizabeth, for a superb run-through of the various legal travails that the former president has in front of him. And no doubt there'll be more updates when we catch up. As you said, we've got the Stormy Daniels episode next. So from a beautiful Tauranga, thanks very much for tuning in. It's haere rā from me.
And from Oamaru, mā te wā. What's the Story, Old Glory is written, produced, edited and presented by Elizabeth Soule and Todd Muller for Old Glory Casting. Our cover art is by Caitlin at Studio Naylor. Our theme music is Shootout at Sundown by Del Boni. You can find us on all the usual social media channels at Old Glory Pod, and send us your questions to oldglorypod@gmail.com.